From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 123 of Little Brother for the 18th of March, 2023. Stay tuned, Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcasts.com, or you can post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcasts.com. So, let's get started. Two weeks ago, in episode 121, I spoke at length about how mental telehealth provider BetterHelp was sending patient data to social media platforms, including Facebook, Pinterest, Snapchat, and Criteo, and that the Federal Trade Commission had stepped in to state the obvious fact that this was not acceptable. This week, The Verge is reporting that another mental telehealth provider, Cerebral, is doing the same thing, sharing the sensitive information of patients with Google, Meta, TikTok, and others. Unlike BetterHelp, Cerebral have self-identified the issue and have posted a notice on their website about the breach of trust, identifying it probably correctly as a HIPAA privacy breach, and have committed to correcting this going forward. Of course, the thing that we need in the cell phone market is less competition, right? Right? Yeah, right. Well, despite that not being the case, T-Mobile is poised to purchase Mint Mobile, a mobile virtual network operator, or MVNO, which largely uses the T-Mobile network for service. T-Mobile is proposing to buy the company for a blend of cash and stock worth approximately $1.35 billion with a B. Mint Mobile customers, on the other hand, are unlikely to receive any sort of compensation. In San Francisco, a pair of lawsuits filed last week are challenging electric automaker Tesla on antitrust grounds. The company is accused of limiting competition in the repair market. The suits do not accuse the company of violating any specific law beyond antitrust controls. However, it is premised on the idea that by limiting the access to warranty and repair work to shops that have been specifically sanctioned by Tesla, they have subjected Tesla owners and lessees to exorbitant costs and long wait times for repairs that could have been seen to by an independent repair shop much more quickly. While there are safety concerns regarding repairs to electric vehicles that differ from those of fuel-powered vehicles such as arc flash, arc blast, and lithium fire issues, Tesla seems in no hurry to make relevant training or accreditation available. Amazon has a number of bricks and mortar stores with a feature called Just Walk Out. The Amazon Go stores, as they're called, allow you to walk into the store, pick items up off of the shelves, and just walk out, and your Amazon account is billed automatically. Naturally, this works by the store recognizing you and correlating what you have picked up with your identity so that it can do that. One of these stores has run afoul of a 2021 law in New York City, which requires that stores that use biometric means to identify occupants of the space must have signage indicating that this is the case. The result is that Amazon is on the receiving end of a class action lawsuit brought by city resident Alfredo Perez. There is not a lot of information yet, as the case has only just been filed this week. However, we will be following this story. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. There's an exploit out for a number of Samsung and Google-branded cell phones. If your phone uses a Samsung Exynos modem, 5123, 5300, 980, 1080, or Exynos Auto T 512, these phones do not properly check format types specified by the session description protocol and can be attacked by a carefully crafted telephone call. The affected devices are Samsung phones in the Sierra 22, Mic 33, Mic 13, Mic 12, Alpha 71, Alpha 53, Alpha 33, Alpha 21 Sierra, Alpha 13, Alpha 12, and Alpha 04 series. Mobile devices from Vivo, including those in the Sierra 16, Sierra 15, Sierra 6, X-Ray 70, X-Ray 60, and X-Ray 30 series, the Pixel 6 and the Pixel 7 series of devices from Google, and any vehicles, and good luck figuring out which ones those are, that use the Exynos Auto Tango 5123 chipset. Google states that patch timelines are likely to vary by manufacturer. However, if you own a device on that list, you are advised to turn off Wi-Fi calling and voice over LTE or Volt features. Of course, part of the problem here is that some carriers have disabled turning off Volt, in which case, if you have an older phone that you can drop your SIM card into until this matter clears, you might want to do that. Of course, as soon as the patch comes out, you know what you need to do. Patch your systems! There is a history of immortalizing phone numbers in song. Let me show you what I mean. Certainly, anyone of Generation X, and probably of many other generations, we all know Jenny's number by heart, right? Right, and maybe some Motown fans might remember another phone number as well. But the great granddaddy of songs about phone numbers has got to be this one from Glenn Miller and his orchestra. So let's take a moment and talk about that phone number, who it belongs to, and what that means to the hacker community. Let's start with the phone number itself. How do you dial Pennsylvania? In the early days of dial telephones, it was a common practice in many parts of the US and Canada to give each telephone exchange a name. This was a holdover from the days when calls had to be placed by an operator. In small towns, the name of the exchange would just be the name of the town. However, in larger cities, where more than one exchange would be needed, these exchanges would be identified by a word that says something about the location where the exchange is located. As it turns out, when put into context, Pennsylvania 65000 is a New York City phone number, and there's no bigger city in the U.S. than that. It rings an area that was, at the time, dominated by the Pennsylvania Railroad and their New York City terminus, which, of course, is Penn Station. But how do you dial it? Well, as it turns out, that depends on where you are and what decade in the 20th century we're talking about. In New York City in the 1940s, and later on the entire country until about the 1960s, you would dial the name of an exchange by dialing its first two letters. So Pennsylvania 65000 would be dialed as PE65000, and that PE becomes the digits 73. We'll talk more on that in a minute. So, I mentioned that the Pennsylvania Exchange in New York City covered the area dominated by the Pennsylvania Railroad, which included Penn Station and a grand hotel built in 1919 by the railroad right near Penn Station, and it was called the Hotel Pennsylvania. The hotel building was divided into four wings that faced south towards 32nd Street. The public rooms were largely on the lower floors and included a ground-level lobby, a restaurant called Café Rouge, and a ballroom level. The hotel originally had 2,000 guest rooms, which started on the fifth floor and made this, at the time, the largest hotel in the world. Now, over the years between 1919 and now, the name of the hotel has changed a few times, to Hotel Statler, then to the Statler Hilton, then to the New York Statler, New York Penta, and finally back again to Hotel Pennsylvania. Throughout all of the different owners that the hotel has had, and throughout all of its name changes, one thing has remained constant all this time. The phone number has always been Pennsylvania 65000. We can probably thank Jerry Gray and John Sigmund for that, for writing the song, and for Glenn Miller for performing it with his orchestra. Miller and his orchestra had a residency at the Hotel Pennsylvania at the time that the song was written and first performed, putting the phone number into a song that then became a 12-week top 5 hit on the Billboard charts, made it a valuable commodity that stayed with the property. So now that we've talked about the telephone enthusiast's interest in this property, let's look at its interest for other hackers. There have been, since their start, 12 conferences, mostly held at two-year intervals, under the banner of Hackers on Planet Earth, or HOPE. Of the 12 conferences, 8 of them were held at the Hotel Pennsylvania, with the marketing for the conference making good use of the nice coincidence that the first two letters of each word in the hotel's name spells out HOPE. Unfortunately, as much as there was a sentimental attachment between the conference's organizers and the hotel, there was no escaping the fact that this was getting to be a pretty old building, which brought its own problems along for the ride. I've heard the occasional horror story from conference attendees, although I must say that the bulk of them seem centered around temperamental old elevators. A few years ago, when the organizers found out that they could no longer afford the Hotel Pennsylvania, the 2018 and 2022 conferences were instead held at St. John's University in Queens. 2020 was intended to be there as well, but was instead held virtually due to the pandemic. So, I told you all of that so that I could tell you the bad news, and that is that the Hotel Pennsylvania is no more. Over the past couple of decades, the hotel's owners have tried on many occasions to close it and demolish it, only to be met by protests that caused them to stand down. The hotel closed permanently in April of 2020, a victim of the pandemic, and this gave the owner the opportunity that they'd been looking for to take it down. To my understanding, as of this podcast, only about a dozen floors of the formerly 22-story building remain, and demolition is expected to be completed by July of this year. So, what happened to the phone number? Well, let's find out. We know from the song that the number is 7365000, and when the song was written in 1940, area codes wouldn't exist for another 11 years yet, but based on its location, we can make an educated guess that the area code is not just any old area code, but the area code. The first area code for New York City, the shortest area code to dial on a rotary dial phone, an area code that carries a great deal of prestige. And that area code is, of course, 212. Let's give him a call.
Hello, you have reached Hotel Pennsylvania. We are permanently closed. For human resources, please press 1. For finance, please press 2. For general information, please press 3. Thank you.
And that's how it is. It's not like the world doesn't know the number, so I will leave it as an exercise to you, dear listener, if you want to call them and see where the phone tree goes. I suppose there's not much point in pressing 1. I really doubt very much that they are hiring. Continuing on the edges of our usual topics, I want to talk a little bit about bank collapses. I'm gonna justify this by saying that the biggest one recently was Silicon Valley Bank, and that's in Silicon Valley. And that's where a lot of tech comes from. And a lot of tech companies use them. Yeah, that sounds good. Plus, one of the topics of this podcast is greed. Go back to the start and listen to the intro if you don't believe me. But that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. But I'm not a financial analyst. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a politician. What I am is an interested techie. And somebody who likes to be prepared. Some people may call me a prepper. For when things go wrong. That's a strong suit to have in the tech business. So, let's talk about how to prepare for bank collapses. Now, to be clear, this is my opinion, and not those of anyone else who may attempt to claim them, including you. If you follow this advice and it doesn't work out, well, I'm very sorry, but it's got to be up to you. It's your decision whether to follow the advice or not, and that decision is yours alone. But basically, this breaks down into 2 parts. The first part concerns your own bank, and the other concerns impacts to your employment by way of other people's money. So, what should you do as an individual depositor? Well, first, it seems to me like diversity is good. As the saying goes, don't put all your eggs in one basket. If your basket falls, you lose all your eggs. If the option is available to you, try to spread your savings out across multiple unrelated banking institutions. If one of them takes a dirt nap, you'll lose access to your money in that institution, but the others may well still be standing. Second, have some cash on hand. And when I say this, I mean literally green portraits of dead presidents. Or as one of my favorite authors put it, small green pieces of paper. Put it in a safe place in your home, maybe divided across a couple of safe places. And if you use some of it, replenish it. While you're at it, you may also want to take a $20 bill and stash it in your phone case. Even if your phone case doesn't have a specific place to put it, a single $20 bill can be folded up and still be thin enough to be unobtrusively tucked into your phone case behind your phone. Having cash on hand will serve 2 purposes. First, it can't be removed from your account because it's not in your account. And secondly, possibly more interesting and more useful, is that it won't stop working if whatever failures we see result in card payments not working, including maybe just, you go to a store and the card machine's broken. Third, take some comfort in knowing that your deposits are insured. If you bank at a commercial bank, your deposits are insured by the FDIC for up to $250,000. And if you bank at a credit union, they are insured by the NCUA for the same amount. This is a practice that was put into place after the Great Depression in order to prevent bank failures from completely wiping out average everyday working people. Don't let this make you complacent, though, because you may still lose access to your money for a period of time while things get sorted out. Now, there are some folks in the prepper community who like the idea of using precious metals such as gold, platinum, silver, or rhodium as a store of value. I'm not entirely sold on the idea because even if you have them, you need to convert them back to something useful at a later date. Unless there is a complete collapse of the dollar, this is probably not going to help any more than keeping cash on hand does and might actually not even help that much. But this is up to you. If it makes you more comfortable, or even if you just like watching it glisten in the light, that's your choice. So fifth, be selective about your banking institutions. I'm literally going to say do your own research here, but unlike most people on the internet, I'm not saying it because I don't want to back up my own point of view. I'm saying it because I probably don't have one that is relevant to you. Research the banking institutions that you have available to you and pick one that you believe to be reliable and stable and strong. I might nudge you gently in the direction of choosing a credit union over a commercial bank, as the lack of a profit motive should make them less susceptible to taking needless risks with your money. But again, that's got to be your choice. And finally, be active in your membership. If you use a commercial bank, try to understand what drives them. If you can become a shareholder, if you can afford that, do it! And try to learn what the company is up to. Vote if you're eligible. Better though, if you choose to bank at a credit union, then you are a shareholder by definition. And in this case, you can, if you've got the bandwidth for it, take part in the credit union's member meetings and vote on the issues that the board brings to the membership, as well as voting on who exactly is on that board. Now, the other half of the problem, that's other people's money. We're not talking about individuals now, but we could be talking about your employer. Some customers of Silicon Valley Bank have been scrambling to make payroll, having lost access to their assets. My suggestions are as follows. First, understand that your relationship to your employer is actually very simple. You do work, and they pay you for it. You cannot allow any deviation from that formula, or you're going to be taken advantage of. It's nothing personal. It doesn't matter how much you like your employer or your boss or any of that. It's not personal at all, and it never was. It's just business. Number two, if you have the ability to do so, put some money into savings. Try to get as much into savings as you can. This is the cushion that you can land on if your employer can't make payroll. This is what will pay the rent, keep the lights on, and keep food on the table. Put it into savings, and don't touch it unless there's a genuine emergency. As I mentioned before, you may want to spread it across multiple banking institutions. Number three is, well, cash. This is pretty much the same deal as it was in the other list, so I'm not going to belabor the point. Number four, if you are, like me, preparing for various emergencies, then you no doubt have got a stock of various supplies on hand, such as food, cleaning supplies, toiletries, etc. While a loss of income would not be the full-blown emergency that we think of when we talk about emergency preparations, it is nonetheless an emergency, and it does properly meet the criteria for an emergency. You can break out those supplies as needed to make ends meet or to help ends meet. Number five, you should always have your resume or curriculum vitae at the ready and be prepared to begin a job search at any time. This is generally a good position to have anyway, as job loss can come from multiple directions, and a loss of income, even if you are still on the books, should be treated the same way as a job loss. My last piece of advice here is possibly somewhat controversial, mostly because it's kind of harsh. But going back to that first point about the relationship with your employer being very simple, in the event that your employer's bank collapses, their obligation to make payroll doesn't disappear. Your obligation to perform work for them is balanced by theirs to pay you for the work that you do. With that in mind, I personally have a rule that I adhere to, and thankfully have never actually had to invoke, and that is simply this. If you don't pay me on Friday, don't look for me on Monday. That's maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, as I would most likely start from a position that this could have been an error or a hiccup, but missing payroll without saying anything about it, that's the corporate equivalent of a no-call, no-show, and you should treat it like it. Continuing to do work for pie in the sky is wasting valuable time that might be better spent looking for new employment. Again, even if the fault is not with your employer, it is their obligation to pay you. And if they don't, you can't be expected to keep working. So, those are my thoughts on girding yourself against bank failures. Once again, please take this advice at your own risk. Hopefully, you will never need it. As usual, we'll end this week's show with the fail of the week. The winner this week is Tesla. One of the features of a Tesla is that you can unlock it with your smartphone. That's really cool, until it isn't. In Vancouver, a fellow named Rajesh Rondev spotted what he thought was his car parked on a Vancouver street, a white Tesla Model 3. By the way, does it seem like 50 or 60 or maybe even 70% of the Model 3s out there are white? What's up with that? Anyway, he spotted a car that he thought was his, a white Model 3. He unlocked it with the app, got in, and drove off. But something felt just a little bit off. There was a crack in the windshield that he hadn't noticed before. His phone charger cable wasn't where he'd left it. Meanwhile, another driver of a white Tesla Model 3 was able to unlock a car that he thought was his and got in and was able to drive it without issue. Next thing Rondev knew, his phone started receiving text from the other Tesla owner, urging Rondev to contact him. It appears that they had gotten into each other's car. After about 90 minutes, the two owners reconnected, exchanged cars, and went on their way. But no doubt, they are both calling into question the security of their vehicles. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fongaboo and The Crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Joe Cadillac and Thriller at Play for story leads. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Fail of the Week music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker, and our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. The use of the following copyright works in this episode is done in a good faith interpretation of fair use. Those would be 867-5309-JENNY, which is performed by Tommy Tutone and copyright 1981 by CBS Inc. Beechwood 45789 is performed by the Marvelettes and is copyright 1962 Motown Records. Pennsylvania 65000 is performed by Glenn Miller and his orchestra and is copyright 1940 by Bluebird Records. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well. Worth approximately $1.35 billion. Let's start that again. The suits do not accuse the company of violating any specific law beyond antitrust. Brilliant. In San Francisco, a number of lawsuits, a pair of lawsuits, it's just two, damn it, and a grand hotel built in 1990 by the Rel... 1919. And Glenn Miller. When the song was written in 1940, area codes wouldn't exist. If you want to call them and see where the phone tree grows. Yeah, the phone tree grows. Like any other tree, I guess, eh? That's how we get little phone trees. The phone tree grows and it sprouts these little telephone-shaped fruits. And then you plant them and then you get more phone trees. That's where all these things are coming from. Some customers of Silicon Valley Bank. Some customers of Silicon Valley Bank. Yep. Yeah, let's get that one out there.